I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. A recent bar shooting that left four dead has added some urgency to getting violent crime under control in Kansas City, Kansas. With the city's police chief retiring weeks before that, there's a lot to juggle. Today, KCK Mayor David Alvey tells us how he's handling that and everything else happening in Wyandotte County's diverse communities. There's today's elections to discuss and a push for county-issued photo IDs. Then, the fate of Missouri's only remaining abortion provider is now in the balance. If the Planned Parenthood Clinic in St. Louis is shuttered, Missouri would become the only state without a legal abortion provider. Stay tuned for the latest on the case. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The Tequila KC Bar has reopened in the 10th and Minnesota neighborhood in Kansas City, Kansas. The reopening came about 2 weeks after two men opened fire in the bar, killing four and injuring five others. That's only one issue on Mayor David Alvey's plate these days. Today's election could have a dramatic impact on the unified government there. Meantime, the T-Bones have been evicted, and the county sheriff has retired, and there's a push on to have special Wyandotte County IDs issued. With us to run down these issues and more is the mayor and CEO of the Unified Government. That's Mayor David Alvey. Mayor, always good to have you here. Welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
Never a dull moment these days. Let's start with the mass shooting at the Tequila KC Bar. How's the community coming together after that tragedy, Mayor?
You know, I think it's interesting. One of the comments from residents, folks who frequented that bar, they asked Eric Gomez to reopen the bar. And so he made some aesthetic changes to the bar to kind of change people's perception, their experience as they came in.
That was a little controversial when he reopened it so soon.
And I can understand that. But again, as he said, there are folks who depend upon that for their livelihood. There are also folks in the neighborhood who come together there. And I think it's actually a sign of resiliency for those patrons, for those folks in the neighborhood to say, this is important to us. We can't allow someone who is not from our community to come in and take away this experience from us.
You know, as the mayor of Kansas City, Kansas, when do you get a phone call about something as dramatic as that?
Depends upon the severity of it. So that morning I received a call after I had awakened. Mm-hmm. So that was Sunday morning. And then I was able to get down there to just to talk to some of the police officers who responded and was able to talk to the bartender who was there and was able to talk to just a couple of the victims' families.
So when you say morning, you mean you were down there in the middle of the night?
No, it would have been
daylight hours,
like 7:30, 8 o'clock, I think I got down there.
That's got to be a call no mayor wants to get.
Obviously,
I don't have any numbers, but, you know, it seems like from my vantage point that violent crime is up in Kansas City, Kansas this year. Am I right about that?
No, actually not. We've seen a downward trend over the past several years. You know, Chief Ziegler, actually is not the sheriff who retired, but Chief Ziegler is retiring, the police chief. Because of some of the operations that were run, they really targeted, for instance, gang activity. You know, a lot of the much of the violence that is perpetrated is, you know, this retaliatory, you know, violence. Mm-hmm. And now this instance was not, but in fact, the violent crime and the crime rate has declined over the past several years.
To what extent, as mayor, do you worry about an incident like this sort of casting this pall over the community and this generating a perception, like I just asked you, that, hey, you've got a problem over there, when in fact the numbers appear to be declining?
Right. I think that's always an issue. I mean, it doesn't take much for people to, you know, come to that judgment that things are not safe. But what I really ask people to do, in fact, and what we're trying to get to is, you know, have a different experience, you know, that's most people, you know, do not experience violence. You know, a lot of the folks who are in involved in violence. There are some which are random. Those folks there definitely was a random shooting. I thought it was significant that the patrons of the bar actually helped to remove those two that individual from the bar prior to the shooting. And what they were saying is, this is our neighborhood and we're taking care of it, and you are being a problem. You need to move on. So I think the signs of resiliency are always there. And I think we have to take a good look at the statistics. You know, it's interesting. So the bar is on Central Avenue. That neighborhood is almost completely, the commercial establishments are very vibrant, almost completely subscribed. It's difficult to find a place to open a shop along Central Avenue.
And it didn't always used to be that way.
It did not used to be that 20 years ago. I think some people would have given it up for dead, but in fact, that's not the case. And that commercial corridor serves very well the people who live in that neighborhood, and those folks in that neighborhood wanted to continue to be successful. They have their livelihoods there. Their families are there. So those kinds of folks will continue to sustain that neighborhood into the future.
Just for the record, one of the alleged assailants is still said to be at large here, right?
Yes, it's correct.
Yeah. Does the city have enough law enforcement officers to do the job right now? Do you have any concerns that way?
Oh, no, I'm very concerned about that. You know, we have, we're down about 50 police officers, and so there's an awful amount, a lot of overtime. Our police officers are under stress for that reason.
You're down 50 officers?
50 officers.
Well, what's going on?
So obviously, you know, it's the perception of law enforcement as really being a problem. It's you know, people want to cast all police officers and all law enforcement into a negative light. And so it's not necessarily attracting people. But there are some things where we've actually, most recent information I have is our recruiting is very in good shape right now. We're bringing more classes in. I think there's other factors that are kind of outside of our control. You often hear that millennials, for instance, do not always look for careers. They it's more towards a gig economy where they might come in, be someplace for 5 or 6 years.
Right.
If you're going to be a police officer, you're really talking about a career, you know, to really do it well, to be trained and to be sustained in that.
If you're down 50, how big is the force altogether? Because that would be a significant percentage, isn't
it? Yeah, we're down about 15%.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Well, give us an update on the department. The chief, Terry Ziegler, has resigned, I believe, in September after a controversy involving the chief's deal to rent a taxpayer-owned lake house.
Right.
What's being done to replace him?
So we have an interim chief. The acting chief is Michael York. So we'll begin the process of going out to hire. In fact, that will be a national search. And so there's a long process that the county administrator, city administrator runs through. It involves, you know, the commission. It involves community groups. It involves other professional police from other forces coming in to help us evaluate candidates.
It's a big decision for a community.
It's a very big decision, yes.
Yeah. When do you hope to have a new chief hired?
I would expect probably 6 months at the earliest, because it is such an important thing. And also because any candidates who might come from outside will have to make adjustments to their current career.
So April, May, June is what you're looking at.
I wouldn't put a date on it. I just don't know right now.
What was your own position, Mayor, on Chief Ziegler's arrangement to rent this lake house? Should that have been allowed?
Yeah, so I've thought about this a lot, and, you know, but people don't understand is that house was in terrible shape. People have this image that this lake house is, you know, got a beautiful view of the lake. It's not. The house was built for those people who came and built the dam and the roads through there. Then we had park rangers living in there for security. It seemed a good arrangement, in fact, to have the police chief live there and do the work. He didn't get rich off this. He didn't do anything that was really, you know, taking advantage. We had people who were in the house before said that, first of all, it smells like mold. There's one of the basement walls, in fact, is not a wall. It's just a dirt wall. If you go in, the heating system was placed in the basement. It pulls all that must and mildew up into the atmosphere. You couldn't even close the front door because the frame was off. So Terry needed a new place to live because of a life change in his life situation. The county administrator knew we had this, knew that Terry was handy, asked Terry if he wanted to do this. The mistake in all this was that, and this this decision was made before I was sworn in. The mistake made here was it should have been brought to the commission just to let them know. And so, and that's been the conversation we've had with the county administrator. There can't be any surprises on this.
And but maybe the question was, did the chief get an opportunity that a regular resident of Wyandotte County wasn't able to get? Maybe somebody else might have wanted to move in.
Sure, that's possible, but they would have had to do the work. And whether that would have happened or not, I don't know. And right, what we have now actually is a house that can be rented and will be rented. Mm.
It was the timing of his retirement, the chief's, related at all to the lake house arrangement, Mayor?
I don't know. You'd have to ask Terry that. But when I was first came on, I met with Terry on a couple of occasions, and I said, I know you're getting close to retirement, so just make sure I have a heads up. And he says, yeah, I'm within a year or two. I'll give you a heads up, and kind of knew this was coming. Whether all that attention made him move a little bit faster, I don't know.
Yeah. Different topic. The T-Bones have been evicted. What happened there?
Well, I think what happened there was that the business model that was being pursued was not sufficient to generate the revenues necessary for them to pay their bills and to continue to pay their utilities and to pay the taxes. It just, I don't know what happened within that organization that caused it to decline. But we have since entering into a new agreement with a new owner of the T-Bones. But the deal has not been signed yet, but it should be soon. He's doing his due diligence as a businessman to make sure that he can sustain it. But what he presented to us at the commission, frankly, was a business plan that not only should generate money for him, for the organization, but also should generate interest and more activity at the Legends. His vision is that you understand there that baseball is going on. That may not be the primary reason people come to this T-Bone Stadium. There'll be other experiences that will not just be during the baseball season, but in fact, we could use that facility year-round. And that's the kind of business plan we need for that.
But the hope is the T-Bones will be playing there again next summer.
That is the hope.
Okay.
Yes.
Again, a different topic here as we visit with Kansas City, Kansas Mayor David Alvey. There's a growing coalition of groups, Mayor, in the county that wants to become the first place in Kansas to issue local IDs to residents. This is called the Safe and Welcoming Wyandotte Ordinance. Advocates say the IDs would make it easier for them to open bank accounts or enroll their kids in school. Is the county going to start issuing these IDs?
So what this conversation has been going on for, even from when I campaigned for mayor. I think you hosted when it first came up at Donnelly College.
Right.
And at that time, you know, I said, look, if for municipal IDs, if people or families lack access to services because they don't have an ID, then we have to take a look at that. We have a responsibility to make sure that our residents, whoever they might be, have an opportunity to access services they need for themselves or for their family.
And who doesn't have the IDs? What kinds of who are we talking about?
So here? What I understand is it could be people who are undocumented.
Okay.
It could be some elderly folks. It could be citizens returning from incarceration. There's a wide range of people who may not be able to access. So what I promised to do is we would take a look at this, and the commission really asked that we do this after the campaign for obvious reasons, because we didn't want really have an admixture of a lot of opposition that was unnecessary. We want to take a straightforward look at this. So in January or February this coming year, there will be a special session, but we will actually look into the municipal IDs, what the cost would be, what the advantages would be, really just how many people would be affected by not having an ID. And so that's one issue. But there's another part of this that is not often and only recently, I think, been put out there for people to understand, and it really was kind of news to me, that it's not just a municipal ID. The ordinance actually is encapsulated in language, which is basically sanctuary city language. And that's another problem altogether. That's another issue, whether we should or should not adopt language that makes KCK a sanctuary city is a much different issue than just municipal IDs.
What would be the pros and cons of making KCK a sanctuary city?
So from what I understand, you know, a sanctuary city simply says that there are people who are avoid contact with, let's say, our law enforcement, because if you witness a crime and you may have information on a crime, you may be reluctant if you don't have this ordinance in place that you might be reluctant to come forward to a police officer and say, hey, I witnessed a crime, and then they start asking questions and you don't have documentation to show who you are. So maybe that might help. It also, the idea would be that these folks who are not documented would say, I'm just reluctant to kind of become and enter into full civic participation because of that status. And so that fear can really work against someone becoming, you know, have full civic participation.
So in a county like Wyandotte, then there's a lot of push behind the idea of having sanctuary city status be implemented here.
Well, yeah, I'm going to differ on that. I think there are some groups that really want to advocate for this. I think the problem is that the real political work, you know, getting the public will behind this is a much bigger task. I'm not of the opinion that we can pass this and then go out and get the public support for it. This is obviously sanctuary cities, you know, ordinances across the nation depends upon the population, really the political persuasion of the populations. I don't think it's a slam dunk in Kansas City, Kansas, or Wyandotte County.
Do you back the idea of sanctuary city status?
I don't back anything which would put us in legal jeopardy with the federal government. I can't, as an elected official, say I'm going to commit our funds to defending lawsuits that might come or that might jeopardize grants and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Whether or not that would happen, I don't know. But I have to be very cautious about this.
So you're still studying the issue, it sounds like.
I am still studying the issue. And as I said, the municipal ID issue was one issue that I promised to bring forward, and we are going to bring that forward. Mm-hmm. But this additional piece, which is the sanctuary city, is something completely different, even though the ordinance encapsulates the municipal ID.
So you're saying the sanctuary city idea is directly connected to the ID card issue, and you got to weigh both of those things together before you move forward.
Yeah, I'm willing to look at the municipal ID first, and we can do that without having to adopt language for sanctuary city.
Okay, if our listeners want to join our conversation today with the mayor of Kansas City, Kansas, the mayor and CEO of the Unified Government of Wyandotte County, David Elvey, our number 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, half of your Unified Government Board of Commissioners is on the ballot today. How significant an election is this from your point of view?
Every election is significant. That's why I encourage everyone, please go out and vote. Don't care who you vote for. Well, I do, but please go out and vote. It's just necessary. You know, when we have voting participation rates of 15% on a good day, that's a sad statement, because we have to establish our future. We have to become involved and make our voices heard to say, where are we going to be?
What's the biggest issue on the commission's plate right now?
Well, I think always the most important issue for any government, but I think maybe for unified government now that I keep trying to bring this forward, is we have to always try to find a way to provide more and better services to improve the quality of life and to generate growth in our community, but at the same time do so in a way that does not impose undue burdens on our taxpayers, financial burdens. And that's a real trade-off. So I think what we have to do is continually find ways to improve services, but also to look at the services we are currently doing to say, how are these strategic investments, catalytic investments in the growth? If we can broaden and diversify our tax base, then we're going to have the funds necessary to do what we need to do across the county.
What do you know about population figures for Wyandotte County? Are you growing, not growing? Where are you right now?
I think we're growing. I think it's slowed down from what we saw just a few years ago, but it's still growing. You know, we have a lot of in migration. I like to point out that if you look across the county, the eight districts across the county, we had about a 6.5% improvement in property tax values, which is a good thing. In one district, which includes Central Avenue, there was an 11% improvement in property values. And so what that means is the tax base grows. But what it says is, if I'm interpreting the data correctly, it says that people are bidding up the affordability. And I was just in a conversation yesterday at Mid-America Regional Council with Mayor Lucas and Chairman Eilert from Johnson County, and talking about affordable housing. And what I'm feeling is that people understand that there's plenty of affordable housing in our community, and they can afford to come in and renovate and make a home there, and that's a good sign.
I was going to say, that's the great hope, or at least that one is. Great hope of Wyandotte County is the opportunity for, you know, great restaurants, but cheaper prices and housing that people can afford.
Right, and so that's where, from the unified government, our responsibility is to make sure that we bring the amenities and the improvements necessary to sustain that and to encourage those kinds of personal and business investments.
You've had this job for a couple of years now, the job of being mayor. Is it what you thought it was going to be?
All that and more.
Is that right?
Yeah. Or all that and less, depending upon how you catch me.
Yeah.
As you know, it is. It's the thing that's surprised me more than anything, I caught a glimpse of this during the campaign, it's the totality of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I am never not the mayor. You know, I wake up in the middle of the night and go, oh my gosh, I'm the mayor. What am I going to do?
Yeah.
And so it's humbling. And, you know, I understand that it's not about me. It's about doing what must be done to improve the outcomes for all of our residents so that we can grow into the future. And so I think the primary task is to help articulate a vision for who we, first of all, where we are, mm-hmm. but who we can become, because the fundamentals are strong within the county. We have to take advantage of those assets, those fundamentals, enhance those, sustain those, so that we can continue to drive growth into the future.
As the mayor of Wyandotte County, Kansas City, Kansas, do you ever get a down day?
Only if I go out of town. And even when I went out of town this year, I was still obviously handling emails, phone calls, dealing with situations. So I guess the answer is no.
It's a lot.
It is.
It's, you know, people don't recognize, even in a medium-sized community, if I can call it that, there's a lot that comes with it.
Right. And so people say, well, do you enjoy the job? And I always say, I don't use the word enjoy. I do the job because I believe I can do it and it must be done. So I just simply want to make sure that I'm doing as well as I can.
You know, the Star just reported, Mayor, that the man accused of gunning down two Wyandotte County deputies last year had two previous cases against him involving violent crimes that were dismissed by the Wyandotte County District Attorney's Office, which apparently wants those cases erased forever. Why is that?
You would have to ask him.
You don't have a feel for that?
I do not.
I'm reading from a Star editorial here. The Star discovered that dozens of documents in two previous cases against accused murderer Antoine Fielder have been inexplicably sealed from public view. Worse yet, when initially asked, the Wyandotte County Clerk of District Court could not explain how the files were sealed or on whose request and approval. It's pretty unusual.
I would agree, but in general, I do not try to speak for other elected officials. That's their responsibility. They have to stand in front of the public and defend what they've done and what they've not done.
You know, speaking of public safety, there's been a lot of concern about the cost of police and fire in the county. What are you doing to bend the cost curve? Does the cost curve need to bend?
I think one of the factors in this is certainly if you look at the aggregate, you look at the percentage that fire and police demand from our budget is certainly high. It's, you know, the upper 50%.
They were big supporters of yours in the campaign.
Yes,
just
they
to
were.
Be clear. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And but again, when we do run a very lean operation, and so we should be spending much more on public works. We should be spending much more on stormwater control. And if we were funding everything the way it should be funded, those percentages would drop. So that's why the percentages don't work. We have tremendous needs. Our fire stations are in generally poor condition, mm-hmm. and they have to be addressed. We have to get good facilities for our firefighters. And I pull up to the pump to get gas at the fleet center, and a deputy sheriff will come by in the car and say, "Mayor, we need new cars." And I said, "I agree. I understand." Hmm. The problem is, again, we have limited resources, and we cannot simply fund pet projects or things that are not going to be productive of growth.
You know, just one more point here. Wyandotte County property taxes remain, you know, still pretty high, at least compared to the rest of Kansas. What steps are you taking to bring those down?
So over the past several years, what we've tried to do is shift more of the burden over to sales tax, and we shifted quite a bit of burden over to the pilot, which is the payment in lieu of tax, which is placed on the BPU bill by the city. So that's a very high rate. That's 11.9%. When I first came on the BPU 10 years ago, the rate was 7.9%. After the Great Recession, because the city was void of funds, decided to, rather than increase the property tax, decided to increase the pilot to generate, on every 1%, about $3.4 million in additional revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a great push to try and reduce the pilot. Unfortunately, if you reduce the pilot by 1%, that's $3.4 million coming out of the coffers. We're running about a $5 million deficit this year, and we anticipate deficits the next several years because of, you know, unfunded pension obligations. We have a large number of people who are scheduled to retire over the next few years, so that's going to increase our payouts and,
right,
you know, health insurance. The answer always is, as Tony Privateer of Mark One always says, sales solves all problems, and so revenue solves all problems. Economic development will solve these problems. It's a long haul.
Hmm. Let's go to Lynn from Kansas City, Missouri. Lynn, you're on Up to Date with Mayor David Alvey. Good morning.
This is on the topic of affordable housing. What is the wait list for Section 8 housing in Wyandotte County?
You know, I don't know. I do know that there is... We have several facilities, and what they really want to do, what the Housing Authority really wants to do, is to try and move people into scattered sites. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot. They don't have a lot of those available.
Mm-hmm.
So they're trying to solve that problem. The Housing Authority has gone through a change. A former director has been hired back, and I think they'll be addressing those questions. But I think if – I'm not sure of that question. If you want to email the office, we could find that out for you.
Okay. Hope that helps. Let's go to Gerard from Overland Park. Gerard, you're on Up to Date.
Hey, thank you for having me on. Hey, so we're a big fan of the shopping areas that are in Wyandotte County. Example, the Legends. Is there a green initiative for Wyandotte to put in more, say, electric plug-ins for hybrids and electric vehicles, more solar sponsorship? We noticed that when we come from Overland Park that we give a lot of our businesses to people that support green initiatives, electric car charging. But when we go up the Wyandotte, we don't have those opportunities. Why is that?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. You know, I know that there are varying, you know, platforms or technologies for charging. We are, we're interested in and will participate in, I believe, the initiative to make sure that there are charging stations as you travel across the country. So if you, along I-70, for instance, in those will all be entered into an app, and people will be able to identify where they can go and get those charging. What we're finding is we're focused in on trying to serve the needs of our community. There just is not much of a demand within our community for electric charging stations. But I do think that as we move forward, especially as the American Royal builds out and we start bringing people from even more, you know, across the country,
right,
there's probably going to be increased demand. And I anticipate, especially as more electric vehicles are sold and distributed, that there will be greater demand, and it's simply demand will drive that.
Mayor, just a final point today. KCOR just did a terrific series on the Quindaro area of your county. People up there tell us they feel forgotten. I know there's a master plan for progress up there. Tell us about it and what the priorities are.
Right. You know, that's a very important piece, I think, of our future because, you know, we've been successful in bringing in large-scale development like the Legends Shopping Center, you know, American Royal, Amazon, Fairfax Industrial District, you know, redevelopment. But what we've left behind in many ways are those neighborhoods which were redlined, you know, 60, 70 years ago.
Right.
And the disinvestment over time has caused a hollowing out of entire neighborhoods. You know, when you look at what Quindaro was, Quindaro Boulevard and the commercial establishments, the vibrant community there, actually it was the same kind of experience I had growing up in Argentine. Argentine was a vibrant commercial center. We had multiple restaurants. We had a toy shop, a Sears store, you know, you name it, anything you needed to get, department store, anything you needed to get, you could get there. Once Indian Springs opened, that all went away. And mm-hmm. I think the same dynamic happened to Minnesota Avenue. It also happened to Quindaro. The question is now, how do you bring that back? The commercial has to be sustained by housetops. We have to find a way to continue to redevelop those neighborhoods which are now vacant.
And what are you doing along those lines?
Right. So we tasked our county administrator last year with the obligation to really look for infill housing strategies. What's going to work for us? So there are some things we can do. First of all, we've got a lot of lots where things have been demolished. Unfortunately, some of those demolitions were placed right back into the ground there. Those are much more expensive to redevelop. But if there was not that the debris placed on the site, we still have the water infrastructure, we have the electrical infrastructure, we have the sewer infrastructure, so those costs are less. We can perhaps waive those fees for hookups for a developer. We can also have a set of pre-approved plans, building plans, that would not require an architect to approve or go back through the process. That can reduce that threshold, but there's still going to be a delta at this point between what you can build for and mm-hmm. then what it will appraise for. And so we're also now engaging banks in the Kansas City area through their Community Redevelopment Act funds to pool their money together so that we can make up that gap so that we can actually have comps so that when you do sell the house, the comps will now prove out and we can start getting even more private lending into that.
That's David Alvey. He's the mayor and CEO of the Unified Government of Wyandotte County. Mayor, sure appreciate you taking some time and sharing your views. Thanks so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
After a short break, we'll be back. We're going to talk about the Planned Parenthood case over in St. Louis and what's the latest with that. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Whether you listen to this program every day or can only tune in now and then, you can get more content about the show in my weekly newsletter. Sign up now at kcur.org/Kraske for exclusive insights from me and highlights from the up-to-date team. It's quick. It's simple. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske to subscribe. Tomorrow, former Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill joins me, and you can bet I'll be asking her thoughts on the impeachment inquiry. You'll want to tune in for my conversation with the senator tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the issue of whether the St. Louis Planned Parenthood Clinic can continue to provide abortions is now in the hands of an administrative hearing commissioner. Planned Parenthood and its St. Louis clinic were in an intense media spotlight last week during a 4-day set of hearings that will determine the facility's fate. A ruling in the case is not expected until early next year. With us now is a reporter who has covered this ongoing controversy. That's Sarah Fenton. She's a health reporter at St. Louis Public Radio, who's been reporting on the story since May when the state failed to renew Planned Parenthood's license to provide abortions at the clinic in St. Louis. This is the only clinic in the state that still provides abortions. Sarah, good morning. Thanks for taking some time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Do you have any sense after watching these hearings what this administrator is going to wind up doing here, Sarah?
The short answer is no.
The commissioner's,
But the commissioner's name is Srinivasa Rao Dandamudi, and he was extremely stone-faced through the entire hearing. The only thing we really know is that he was appointed by former Governor Jay Nixon, who was a Democrat. But it's still difficult to tell because the Administrative Hearing Commission usually doesn't hear cases of this sort of explosive political nature. If you look at the case dockets, it's usually like disputes over car lots and things. And so the short answer, it's anybody's guess at this point.
So it's been reported that he's going to rule by early next year, or at least that's the expectation. Has he said that? How do we know that?
So you can posit a lot by looking at the deadlines for the briefings that the lawyers need to submit. And so obviously they submit depositions as testimony, and then they submit briefs, and then the other lawyers reply to those briefs, and then there's, I think, another round of replies. And so by looking at the deadlines for those briefs, we can basically assume that the absolute earliest this would happen is in February, and it might not even be until after that.
So when he finally rules, can his ruling be appealed, or is this the final order that will settle the case once and for all?
So the entire hearing came about because a circuit court judge ordered that the state needs to make a decision on whether this was okay or not, that this license wasn't renewed. And so a court Planned Parenthood originally had sued the state in circuit court. And so Planned Parenthood has made it known that depending on how the commissioner rules, they will be appealing that decision. As far as the state's recourse, I would have to get back to you on that. I don't actually know if they can actually go through court because of the way it got to this commission.
Right. Were there many noticeable differences between, you know, these administrative hearings and what would happen in a regular court of law?
Yes, I think because even though this is a really politically, again, a politically explosive issue. We're still talking about a regulatory hearing, right? And so anyone who was in the room last week could say that these hearings were much more technical than you would usually hear. There was a lot of focus on regulatory processes, medical and legal definitions. It was really weedsy and wonky. And so I think it was definitely not as sort of dramatic as what you might see in a court of law.
We're talking about the legal proceedings engulfing Planned Parenthood and its St. Louis clinic with Sarah Fentum. She's a health reporter at St. Louis Public Radio. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, there were a lot of headlines that came out of this hearing last week, this set of hearings. How tense was the hearing room?
I wouldn't characterize it necessarily as tense most of the days. It was a week-long hearing. There were 4 days' worth of hearings. Some of the testimonies from witnesses were more emotional than others, especially I'm thinking of the head of surgical services at the clinic. Her name is Kawana Shannon, and she teared up a little during the last day of the hearing. Most of the time, it was... Again, really sort of like working your way methodically through these legal and regulatory definitions.
Right.
And I even saw some of the lawyers from the different sides of the dispute kind of like chatting. And, you know, I didn't get a sense of a lot of animosity, definitely.
Right. Well, let's go to some of these headlines that came out of these hearings last week. One of them was it came to light that Randall Williams, who's the director of the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services, which oversees these clinics, had requested this year medical information from patients that included the date of their last menstrual periods. This information was in a federal database. Sarah, this was an explosive revelation. Explain to us, why did he want that information? I think that's been lost in the shuffle here a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, to be clear, the state health department denies that Dr. Williams was the person who requested that information. The state health department says that it was another licensing regulator that worked under him. And the data requested from the federal government did come, though, with the attachment labeled director's request. So do with that what you will. They say it was a typo. And basically what the state said during its testimony was it was trying to figure out who had multiple abortion procedures during the same year by looking through those federally available medical records. And the state has a right to look at those records. They had the patient's name redacted. Once they looked at those multiple procedures, they used those medical records, including the date of the last menstrual period, to determine if there had been cases in which multiple procedures indicated a failed abortion on the part of the clinic. So if you're looking at two abortions within, you know, like 7 months of each other, that would indicate probably a failure on behalf of the clinic. If you're looking at two failed abortions within like maybe 2 weeks, or two abortion procedures, excuse me, during 2 weeks, that would indicate that there was something wrong with the clinic. So they used those. I think it ended up being maybe like 67 patient records to determine what they needed to look at in terms of this inspection.
You know, I mentioned that this information was kept in a federal database. Do you know why?
As far as I can tell, it's completely legal for the federal government, CMS, and, you know, the Bureau of Vital Statistics to keep medical information. Beyond that, I can't really tell you.
Right. The other item that caught a lot of attention last week was this news that William Coble, if I'm saying his name correctly, the state's section administrator for licensure, had started accompanying the inspectors from the state on their visits to Planned Parenthood. A Planned Parenthood official testified that hadn't happened before. Do we know why he started doing this, Sarah?
Mm-hmm. Well, according to the testimony from Dr. Williams, who is the head of the health department, Coble started accompanying regulators on their visits because of what he referred to as this increased tense environment between the regulators and the clinic's doctors and administrators. Planned Parenthood is inspected every year. That was another issue that came up during the hearing is why is this abortion provider inspected every year when other providers aren't nearly inspected that often? And Kawana Shannon, who I mentioned earlier, a lead administrator at the clinic, said after COBOL started coming, the investigations grew more tense and adversarial, and Planned Parenthood contends that's proof that state regulators weren't just looking to inspect the facility during this annual meeting. They were looking for a reason not to renew the license.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that tension. How did that tension manifest itself? Did that come through in the hearings?
Again, Kawana Shannon said that it was just sort of like an aggressive inspection, regulators were looking at things that had never been an issue before. I remember distinctly during her testimony, she was talking about this dispute over like a shelf that was, I think, broken or something. And so things that had never really been an issue before in terms of the inspections that had happened, again, for two decades since this clinic had opened, were all of a sudden an issue with this investigator and also or inspector, I mean. Mm-hmm. And William Coble had never been on these inspections before.
Right.
And usually someone of that sort of location in the hierarchy wouldn't come. Usually it's sort of the people that work under him. And so the fact that there was this sort of more high-level regulator coming was a departure from the norm.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about these hearings last week that took place that will determine whether the Planned Parenthood Clinic in St. Louis can continue to offer abortions. It's the only clinic in the state that currently offers abortions, so a lot of spotlight being placed on this case right now. There was also, Sarah, this ongoing disagreement over pelvic exams at the clinic. What was that disagreement about?
Mm-hmm. And so there was a new state statute that required people who are receiving abortions, even these medication abortions, which is where you take a pill as opposed to a surgical abortion, to receive a pelvic exam before the procedure. And physicians at the Planned Parenthood Clinic here in St. Louis have maintained throughout this entire process that they think those are invasive and that they are medically unnecessary. And something that came out during Kawana Shannon's testimony, again, on the last day of the hearings, was recounting kind of how difficult it was during the clinic's time doing these pelvic exams before medication abortions. It was for the physicians, and she actually cried during her testimony a little bit, and everybody had to take a break. And so the clinic did those for, I think, a couple days and then made a decision that they weren't going to offer medication abortions anymore because they didn't want to do these pelvic exams. They just considered it too traumatic for both the patients and for the health providers there. And so what the clinic does now is it actually sends any patients who are going to receive a medication abortion, they send them over the river to the clinics in Illinois because there's not that statutory requirement for the pelvic exam. So that's sort of how they got around it. But that means that they don't give medication abortions at this clinic anymore.
Right. One other thing caught my eye here, Sarah, and that was this idea that Planned Parenthood officials thought that the state regulators were investigating their clinic because of complaints from a patient out there, of some patient that had been at the clinic in the past. But it turned out, based on testimony last week, that that wasn't the case. Who had, in fact, complained?
Right. I think this whole investigation stemmed, this was from Dr. Williams' testimony, the investigation that occurred, it stemmed from a single patient that was flagged during that routine inspection. And so, but the complaint that actually set off the investigation, originally it was understood that it was from a patient. It actually came out during testimony that was from that licensing regulator, William Coble.
So it's the same William Coble who was accompanying inspectors on their rounds at the clinic was the one who had initiated the complaint. That doesn't strike me as offering someone who's fairly neutral on whether the clinic should be licensed or not, or am I missing something there?
Well, I think it obviously depends on who you ask, right? Mm-hmm. I think the state regulators, all the way up to Dr. Williams, would say, like, we are just doing our jobs. We are trying to make sure that the clinic is a safe place. And these regulators were doing their jobs by investigating what was going on there. If you talk to people, you know, on the, you know, Planned Parenthood side, they would say, absolutely not. These people were searching around. They were looking for a reason to shut us down because they're working under the assumption that abortion isn't something that they want people to be able to have access to. Mm-hmm. So it just depends on who you ask. And that was the tension ultimately in during the entire week, last week during the hearing.
You know, if you go back in time a little bit here, Sarah, to June when the state decided not to renew this license, I'm wondering how suddenly did the decision not to renew the license come about, and to what extent was Planned Parenthood caught off guard by this decision?
I don't think they were necessarily. It wasn't like all of a sudden the license renewal was denied. I think they knew it was coming. I don't think it was, you know, like a shot out of the blue. What had happened was investigators wanted to interview certain physicians that worked at the clinic, some of them who were Planned Parenthood physicians and some who were fellows and residents who weren't necessarily Planned Parenthood employees. And investigators wanted to interview these physicians in a certain order. And Planned Parenthood refused, said we can't even compel these physicians to do that because they don't work for us. Mm-hmm. And so after that, I think both the clinic and the state regulators knew that this was going to become was going to be an issue, right? Because both sides said this is completely an unprecedented situation. And so I think the one of the only things that they're in agreement about is that this is an unprecedented situation. Right. And, you know,
So the decision not to renew the license, did that mean the clinic could no longer operate at all or just not provide abortions?
Well, I think that's a really good question. And thanks for asking it, because there are lots of Planned Parenthood clinics in Missouri. I think there are, you know, at least a handful here in St. Louis. Only one of those Planned Parenthood clinics provides abortions here in St. Louis and in the entire state of Missouri. So what this license is basically saying yes or no on is the abortion provider within that Planned Parenthood clinic in St. Louis. So all of the other Planned Parenthood clinics are unaffected by this decision, no matter what happens. Mm-hmm. And what happened was, after that license was denied, there was a judge in that circuit court, Judge Michael Stelzer, who he issued a restraining order, I think it was, or he issued an order that kept the clinic open. And then after that expired, the commissioner, the Administrative Hearing Commission, also extended the license. So long story short, the clinic is still operating. It's still providing these procedures while this dispute is getting hammered out.
And again, we think likely early next year at some point, but we don't know exactly when we'll have a final decision here then.
Right. And after that decision happens, it is, I'm sure that we will not be hearing the end of the story.
Yes. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for your time. That's Sarah Fentum. She's a health reporter at St. Louis Public Radio who's been covering this story since May. Thanks again for your time, Sarah. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the show, the basketball players from Central Kansas who took the sport to its first Olympic Games in Nazi Germany back in 1936. Join us for this little-known piece of history. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Yesterday in the show, we talked about Harriet Tubman. You can hear that conversation and why her life still resonates today at kcur.org/up to date. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.